Session number 8939, Captain Ian Hamilton, Reel 6.
I think you were saying that you didn't have much to do with the Canadians, but you did have a bit to do with the Avray. How did you find them? What impression did you get on? Did you get of them, and how did you get on with them?
Oh, we got on with them extremely well. Well, we had to. They were very methodical people, very dedicated people, and they certainly knew what they were doing. And they tackled things in a totally different way to the way we did. I suppose we'd all been brought up to go zooming off and dealing with things as they turned up, whereas they had a more calmer approach to things and sorted things out first, and then decided what the problem was and how it should be solved, and then got on and used their equipment to solve it. Oh, we got on very well with them.
You didn't find the difference in approaches led to any friction or
I didn't.
Misunderstanding?
No. The squadron commander of the Avery squadron I was dealing with, I liked him very much. We got on very well together.
Could you perhaps say that the spirit of the Avery was a more scientific spirit?
Oh, I'm sure, yes.
Whereas your spirit in the converted tank regiment was still more of a cavalry spirit.
Yes, yeah, an outlook, yes.
Had you practiced with the Avery in combining flails with petard tanks and other...
Yes, we practiced with them first of all at Orford and then latterly in the New Forest near Burford.
What about cooperation with other arms of the service? You mentioned doing some exercise with infantry. Did you ever do anything with the artillery or with other services like the Air Force in support?
No, no, we didn't. Well, as far as the Avery were concerned, they were almost us and we were them. That's how close we were. The team was a combined team, although it consisted of mixed units.
That was based upon some months of close contact, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. And this is what I think paid off on D-Day itself.
Had you reached the stage where you could almost tell instinctively what your counterpart was thinking and could predict what he was going to do without asking him?
No, I don't think that arose. Not in my case, anyway. We knew what the options were for tackling different obstacles, and we knew that one or other of the options would be used depending on the equipment that was to hand. Don't forget that each breaching team for D-Day was set up to deal with the particular point on the French coast where it was going to land. So it was equipped for that purpose. It had a full back plan if the main one didn't work, but that's as far as it went, I think.
Who was in the breaching team that you were in then?
Three flails and two Avrys and an armoured bulldozer, who was also Avery, of course.
What sort of Avrys were they? What did they have?
Well, one was the bridge, SWG bridge. The other one, I think, but I can't remember, I think was a fascine, because we had an anti-tank ditch ahead of us. But of course, they all carried petards anyway.
So this was a team of six vehicles. What happened to the other two flail tanks in your troop?
Well, after getting up the sea wall and flailing down to the first lateral, they turned right. Now, I'd lost my tank, but I sat, instead of taking over from the team, I didn't want to upset the team. So I sat on the with the commander of the sergeant
but
and went with them. And we linked up with the other half of my troop, which had landed with the next team along. we landed at Bayonne-sur-Mer, as you know, and that my troop sergeant's assault team landed at a point where there was no sea wall, but there was a very gradual slope up to a level crossing. It was very close to the little station that used to be there, and right next to the house which still stands there and which appears in every picture of Bayonne. After my tank was hors de combat, and while the others were dealing with the chains and flailing down the to the first lateral, which took some time, I walked along the top of the sea wall to go and see how my sergeant was getting on, and I found they'd already got in and they'd started to turn down the first lateral. The anti-tank ditch crossed the lateral. So I came back again, and by this time the other two had finished flailing and they turned along the lateral, and they were trying to get the bulldozer to deal with the anti-tank ditch, and that was soon done. It was at that point that two Frenchmen came up to me and greeted me, although I wasn't sure whether I could trust anybody, so I just said, hello, nice to see you, sort of thing. But that was all. My own crew were sitting on top of the sea wall with a machine gun. They had an odd crack at a few odd snipers, but that soon passed away. And they set about heating up some self-heating soup, from those marvellous cans of self-heating soup. They discovered the next day they'd been sitting on a telemine, but that didn't matter.
So your troop was actually split up into two separate teams?
It was, yeah.
Were you in command of the breaching team, of which you were a member?
Yes, I was in command of my team. But the other team was commanded by Avery, troop leader.
When were these teams actually formed?
While we were in the New Forest, as far as I know. Oh, they may have been formed on paper before that, of course, but that's when we first got to know each other in great detail.
So you had actually trained together?
Yes.
As teams?
Yeah. This is what was important.
And did you have one team per LCT?
Yes. Yeah. It just took five or six tanks.
I think you said that you embarked at Lymington, at Gosport, mm-hmm. taken round into the harbour at Southampton.
I imagine it was Southampton. Yeah.
But you didn't know at the time?
No. Yeah.
And you said you were then cooped up there for?
Several days.
Several days.
Very hot. Some fool had a dive into the dock for a swim, regretted it. He came out covered with oil.
What could you do when you're on this LCT?
Nothing. Write letters. We received the Commander-in-Chief's little homilies. We had one from Monty. We had one from General Crerar, and one from Eisenhower. And I got my troop to sign Monty's.
Did these little homilies have any effect on the team?
Only insofar as it made us realise that we were part of a very large whole, I think. You know what troops are, they tend to laugh these sort of things off. But if you mean did it have the effect that Henry V's had at Agincourt or at Harfleur, I don't think it worked quite like that. Not outwardly, anyway.
How did you get on with the Navy? Presumably they were running the LCT.
Extremely well. Extremely well. My skipper was a chap called Holland, and so he was known to everyone as Dutch. What else about him I don't know, but he took us out a number of times. On one occasion he had two wrens aboard who were supposed to be boxing the compass, but whether they boxed the compass or what else I don't know. But they were tremendous. On the crossing itself, he first of all invited me up to the bridge when we first left the harbour, and it was a fantastic sight, of course, absolutely fantastic. We were right up in the front of our particular line. I think there were only the minesweepers ahead of us. But behind, it was as if you were pulling a string out of a box, all the landing craft coming out one after the other in two lines. And as we passed the island and crossed the bar, I said, I suppose I'd better open my bag, my sandbag with the maps in. It was while I was going down to the cabin to get it that I passed the exhaust from the motors of the ship, the engines of the ship, and that's when I began to feel queasy, and of course we were beginning to rock a bit. Up to that point I had enjoyed the smell of diesel smoke, but from that point onwards in my life I didn't. I got them open, I got the relevant maps to the other tank crews on the ship, and that was it. I was sick. And Dutch Holland offered me his bunk, and I was in and out of his bunk and the heads or over the side for the rest of the journey.
Presumably there wasn't very much room to move about on the...
No, the tanks were all shackled down. The crews were in the tanks, there was nowhere else for them to be, or they were on deck. As the landing craft headed into the rollers, there was a thud, and it slipped sideways and upwards and downwards and all ways, and the water that splashed over onto the deck sloshed from one end to the other with sandwiches and vomit and bits and pieces, oil.
Others were being sick as well then, were they?
Oh yes, yes. Not everyone. In fact, I think the only person who wasn't sick was the skipper. Even some of the sailors were sick. But I honestly didn't take much interest in the proceedings.
How long did the crossing last?
Well, we set out, I imagine it was early evening. I don't know. I think it was about 6 o'clock in the evening, but I may be wrong. And it took all night because we were going pretty slowly. And we landed at seven-ish next morning. I've forgotten the exact time. One thing that did impress me, and I must mention this, when I opened the sandbag, not only did I find the larger map, the quarter-inch map of the whole area, and then we knew where we were going, I also found this other one, which is the 2.5 inches to the mile, and the very, very detailed map, indeed, of Bernier itself, which showed where we were landing, and showed all the defence information, the height of the seawall, the kind of beach, the kind of guns in the blockhouses, the minefields, the telephone lines, the wire, everything. But in addition to that, there were several photographs. There were photographs of families sitting on the beach building sandcastles, but of course with the seawall in the background. These had been collected during the previous 2 years, and what has amazed me ever since has been the tremendous organisation in sorting out the thousands of holiday snapshots, because the government asked for snapshots of the beaches from Spain to Norway, I believe, or anyway, a very, very great distance, and these were sorted out down to our individual place. And in addition to that, there were aerial photographs taken a couple of weeks before from a low-flying mosquito showing the Germans working on the sea defences on the beach and running as the plane approached.
So it was a highly accurate representation of what you actually encountered?
It was highly accurate. The one thing it didn't tell us was how the enemy were going to react. And in fact, at Bernier, where we were, when I landed, they wanted to surrender, and they came out in their pyjamas. I think we had more trouble from an Alsatian guard dog. Now, I know that the Régiment de la Chaudière, on whose beach I landed, suffered a lot of casualties, and so did some of the others further along. But it was not for very long. At the end of D-Day, after we'd done all the various jobs we had to do, we finished somewhere about 1 o'clock in the middle of the night, having cleared a field outside the town for a dump. We just lay down by the side of the tanks, and of course I was soaking wet still. Somebody had been back to the tank to locate our blankets, and they were soaking wet with oil and sand and seawater, and we just lay down in there until somewhere in the middle of the night a lone German plane appeared, and everything that could fire fired at it, and I believe it dropped an odd bomb that hit something. It was bound to hit something. And early in the morning, some Frenchmen came to us and saying, "Russe, Russe!" We wondered what on earth they were talking about. And then we looked up, and 150 yards away from where we'd been that night, there was a German trench with men with their hands up. And they were Russe. They were Russian soldiers in the German army. Their pay books were all in Russian. But they were not interested in fighting.
When you arrived off the beach and were making the run in, did the landing craft have to stop and form up offshore, or did they just go straight in off the
There was the column of movement? A certain amount of... No, as I remember it, we chugged over in convoy at a fairly slow speed, and then as we got a few miles off the coast, we began to pick up speed. And we were searching, of course, for our landmarks, but the navigation was so good we could pick out Bernier Church quite easily. And it was only this business of bumping into the rocket launcher that put us slightly off course.
Was the rocket launcher then out of place?
I don't know. Maybe he was. I remember as we passed, as we scraped alongside, there was this ripping sound, like calico being ripped apart, and a flight of rockets went up. You could hear it even above the radio because we'd just switched on. And I saw a Spitfire flying along the beach, and it suddenly disappeared in a puff of flame and smoke. It must have flown into the flight of rockets. You could see them landing on the shore, on the not on the beach, but on the land behind the beach, and the fire burning and the smoke, a tremendous amount of smoke.
Other than those rockets, which were presumably going a few miles inland,
no, I don't think they were on the town on the shore, just behind the beach.
So it would be a few hundred yards then.
Mm.
Was there other fire support for you as you were?
Yes,
in.
You could hear the heavy stuff coming overhead. The battleships, there was the Warspite and so on, firing over our heads at some target or other, I don't know what.
What was the condition of the beach when your landing craft actually touched down? Was there anybody on it, or was it just
empty? There were some infantry were already on it, and there were quite a lot of bodies floating about. They seem to have got there before we did.
Was that according to the plan?
I'm not too sure. I can't really be accurate about this. I don't know whether they were or not. I know that we were a little later getting there than we should have been. Quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, something like that.
You also mentioned that you had some trouble caused by submerged obstacles.
Yes.
On the sort of surf line or that zone. Did you know anything about the arrangements that have been made to clear those?
Well, I knew that there were to be beach clearance parties, but of course the storm, the bad weather, had brought the tide up, and there was an onshore wind, and so the tide was a lot higher and the water was much deeper further out. We'd expected a run of several hundred yards on dry beach, and in fact we didn't have a great deal. I can't remember how much. We had some dry beach.
So if I get the idea from what you were saying earlier on, the original idea was that you would get flails off the LCT through the surf. They would flail a path over on the sand.
Yes.
Or the beach. Was it a sandy beach?
Sand, yeah, beautiful sand.
The bridge layer would follow them.
Mm-hmm.
The bridge layer would then put its bridge up to get you over the sea wall.
That's right.
The flails would go over the bridge.
Yes.
Flail inland to the lateral road.
Mm-hmm.
And then go along it to clear a sort of strip, yeah, immediately beyond the beach.
That's right.
What were the petard tanks supposed to be doing then? Well, the bobbin tank and the fascine
we didn't have
tank.
Any. We didn't have any bobbin.
You didn't have a bobbin.
Because that was only used where there was going to be mud.
Or soft sand.
Or soft sand. And ours was presumably hard sand. Well, it was. And still is. The petard was used, it could only be used when they dropped their bridge or dropped their fascine, or if they weren't carrying one of those things. And in fact, they didn't use the petard. I beg your pardon. One of them was used. He turned sideways on or something to have a crack at the sea wall, and he blew at the sea wall, but it blew through the wall instead of breaking the whole of the wall up, and we couldn't get up it.
You wanted to make a breach with
a
slope, yeah, of rubble to climb.
Yeah, something like that.
What sort of charge did the petardier throw?
I think it was called a flying dustbin, and it was, I think, 14 pounds of explosive.
How far could it actually project one of these dustbins?
Not very far. Memory. I doubt if it would carry 100 yards. Yeah, they had to get up pretty close, but it was devastating when it hit something. It just happens that the seawall was such a construction that it didn't want to be devastated. Not that it was thick, I don't think it was, but it just didn't break up that way.
Were there any mines on the beach?
Not on the beach itself, no.
Just on the strip behind?
Only attached to the various tetrahedra and poles which were set into the beach. Each one had a mine or an anti-aircraft shell, an artillery shell on it.
Were there they a real nuisance to you, apart from snagging the ramp of the LCT?
Well, that was the nuisance. I mean, once that had happened, they were of no further interest to us. The follow-up troops may have had some trouble, especially with a number of landing craft that were sunk and so on, blocked things. When I was at college after the war, one of the second years who joined us turned out to be a commander of one of the follow-up wave landing craft, and he took two photographs of Bernier Beach, which I've got in the history, and it shows there quite a lot of debris on the beach, sunk craft and so on and so forth.
But they weren't there when you arrived?
No.
What was the town like? What condition was that in when you first saw it?
Well, I didn't go into it. I went round it. According to our map and information, the beach houses that had been behind the seawall had all been demolished, except for that one big one which is still there, and the little railway station, which is now the Syndicat d'Initiative. There were minefields, and they were wired off, marked, and burning. Well, the grass was burning. We had to deal with those in the days after D-Day.
But not on the day itself.
All we were concerned with was clearing an exit from the beach, putting up the windsock to show that it was clear so that follow-up troops could aim for it. After clearing the first lateral, I was asked by the Canadians to come and flail through one of the minefields to the side of the town, and I went through parts of the town which didn't appear to be terribly damaged, but I can't really remember.
Can you remember which side? Was it on the La Rive side or the...
It was on the...
On the right-hand side of the town.
It was this side of the town.
So it was on the La Rive side.
La Rive. It was through here somewhere.
So they were presumably trying to outflank anything that was in the...
Yes.
In the town.
Yeah, it was probably that one. Or this one. I can't tell you for now. Because they were aiming, of course, in the Caen direction. And then after that... That's where I saw the carrier upside down. After that, we were called upon to flail all the way around the field on the other side of Bernier for a dump. And as we flailed round the field, all round the edge, to prove it, that there were no mines, the ducks were beginning to come in, laden with ammo, or petrol, or whatever it was, and started dumping behind us. And as we got right the way round to where we started from, they were right round behind us.
And you didn't find anything?
Didn't find anything.
You said there was a bit of sniping.
Yes.
Did that cause you any serious trouble or casualties?
Not to us. I didn't have any casualties in my troop at all. Only my own tank.
Was the beach under fire from artillery or machine gun? Or
not at that
when you
point.
Came ashore?
Not to my knowledge. It must have been. It must have been. Because some of the infantry were hit. But I wasn't aware of it.
But were they being hit when you arrived, or had they been hit previously?
They'd been hit. Whether they were being hit while I was in action, I don't know, because I wasn't interested. I don't mean that callously.
You're too busy.
I was too busy. Too busy. And you know we had orders that under no circumstances were we to stop for casualties. That's one of the hardest things of all, I think.
What sort of condition were the Canadians in when they asked you to go forward and deal with the minefield?
Oh, they were okay. They were coping. They didn't seem worried. They were a bit shaken that this carrier had gone up in the way it had, I think. The people nearest to the chaps who were in it, because one of them was pinned underneath it, I could see. He was dead.
What sort of formation were they in then? Were they...
Well, they were preparing to advance across what would become open country within it was just the edge of the open country. So as soon as they got round it, round through this minefield, they would be advancing across open country, so they'd open out.
Into what? What did you see them going forward?
No, I didn't.
Who was your rear link when you were doing this D-Day assault?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know.
So you don't know who you were working for?